Thank you. Well, thank you for your introduction, and also, of course, want to thank organizers of this wonderful workshop, myself, the Mizzi, and Fields Institute. Not being a mathematician myself, I somehow took the word mathematics in the title of the workshop as seriously as I was able to. So instead of raising like any significant big issues in process semiotics, I chose to talk about one relatively small episode in Charles Peirce's career as a geodesist and a mathematician. This episode is relatively well known among Peirce scholars, but is, for some reason, is rarely mentioned in non-biographical research, literature on Peirce. Well, I believe that if this episode is put in a proper context, it will, well, at least I believe it may, show how some of Peirce's mature pragmatist and semiotic ideas developed from his early practice as a scientist and as a mathematician, thus providing an interesting example of the intersection of scientific practice and philosophical speculation. Peirce's careers as a scientist and as an academic philosopher overlapped in 1879. Of course, if it is at all possible to talk about academy at that time, because there were in the middle of 19th century, up to the end of 19th century, there were no professional journals, and the only university proper in the whole country was Johns Hopkins University. Others were just, including Harvard, they were just colleges. They didn't have any established practice of doctoral defense, nothing like that. But anyway, that year, Peirce started teaching at the Johns Hopkins University as a professor in logic, while he also continued his research for the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey as assistant. In May that year, Peirce published a very short, very brief paper, just a little bit over 2 pages, in the American Journal of Mathematics. The paper described his new map projection, which he called Greenkankiel. The name of the map, as is, I believe, well known, comes from two Latin words, quinque and uncia, standing for Roman coin, which contained 5/12 of an ounce of silver, and in which the silver content was signified just in the manner in which this number is signified on dice, on a die. As to coins, it is also might be interesting that just a few years after his appointment at Johns Hopkins, in mid-1880s, Peirce also was appointed as a member of several commissions on weights and measures, and closely collaborated with the United States Mint in Philadelphia. In his letters, Peirce acknowledged that the idea of his projection was inspired by studies of German mathematician Karl Hermann Schwarz, known for his work in complex analysis. And Peirce's map was a diagrammatic picture, in fact, one of the first of this kind, created with an application of complex analysis. This map was a transformation of conformal, or as Peirce uses the different term, he uses the term orthomorphic stereographic projection. That is basically the projection of the following kind. And this is the picture of the map itself. I'm sorry for the quality of pictures. Curves are sort of not very well seen. Well, the difference with the standard case here is that this projection is arranged, as you see, not in a circle, but in a square. However, like other conformal projections, this map preserves intact the angles between at which curves cross each other on a sphere. And as in stereographic projection, as you see, one of the poles in this map is situated in the center, while another is at infinity. That is, it is distributed along the perimeter of the square, the bigger square. At the same time, you may see that Peirce's map deviates from the standard stereographic projection in that it is actually a projection not of a sphere, but of hemisphere, where the other hemisphere is split into four. I don't know whether it seemed that clear. You see that the small square that is inscribed in the big one, and one hemisphere is in this inscribed square, and the other one is distributed in triangles that surrounds this small square. Also, this map can be tessellated by iteration of its parts. Like this. We have the map, and we start multiplying as pieces. And this tessellation may be continued in any direction as infinitum, at infinitum. And we can do it until we have every part and every point of the imaginary sphere depicted on this map connected with every other part and point. This is a very interesting feature of this kind of projection because this map has no edges. We can go on forever in any direction. And as it has no edges, we can lay a continuous, uninterrupted route in any direction on this map, which is not possible in case of other projections like Mercator and others. It is the future that, as I will try to show, makes this map a sign of the Earth's surface and a virtual picture, precisely in the sense which Peirce ascribed to these two terms, sign and virtual. Anyway, before talking about how the map is relevant to Peirce's semiotics, I want to talk about the aforementioned context. And I will probably talk about this context more than I will talk about the map. And then I will come back to the map in the end. This context can be divided into two parts, one being theoretical, another being biographical. And I'll start with the biographical one and then go to theoretical one. Why biography is, and historical context is important here. See, Peirce is one of those cases where it is really important. First of all, there is this ugly but pretty interesting and long story behind all the attempts at the research of Peirce's life, including all the scandals around and with participation of Harvard officials who, for some reason, didn't want to give access to researchers for researchers to Peirce's manuscripts and letters, downright theft of Peirce's manuscripts and letters, and so on. But apart from that, Hearst lived in a very interesting period of American history, which brought about a unique type of intellectuals, almost all of them scientists, many of them mathematicians, the type of which Peirce was a good example and which emerged right after, in America, right after the Civil War and completely disappeared before the end of 19th century. It was a time when many interesting things happened. It was the time of the rise of mathematical statistics. It was a time of a war of currents between Edison and Tesla. It was a time when first alkaloids were synthesized. It was a time when electric chair was introduced, and many other wonderful things like that. In short, it was the end of Victorian era, and it was the time of totally psychotic society, much more psychotic than the one we have now. Anyway, Peirce in many ways was a product of that time. He was quite an eccentric character. In particular, what is interesting for the present case is that he seemed to believe in specific interconnectedness between certain features of his own personality, and he actually tried to find some sort of theoretical explanation of this interconnectedness. Among these personal features, Peirce laid special stress on his quite early discovered disposition toward diagrammatical thinking. That is, he had a habit of thinking in terms of diagrams, maps, and other images rather than linguistic units. And he was inclined to attribute this capacity to his mathematical mindset. Peirce thought mathematical thinking essentially to be an interplay of maps and diagrams. And like Peirce, his father and his older brother, James Mills, the whole family were practically mathematicians except the younger brother who was a diplomat. When I think about it, I often recollect A Beautiful Mind, a movie with Russell Crowe. I mean, sorry for this digression, but there's an episode there when John Nash, a real mathematician and Crowe's character, at some point looks at the window and sees kids playing in the yard. And when he sees kids playing in the yard, he begins to cover a window pane with mathematical formulas that he thinks describe the scene. So he sort of uses the window pane as transparent medium that is covered with algebraic signs that overlap with the picture that they describe. There's sort of an idea of immediate translation of the visual into algebraic, and for Peirce, that was specifically a mathematical way of putting things. Peirce also deeply believed in logical advantage of diagrammatic and picture-like way of expression compared to ordinary writing. Visual iconic experience, in short, was to him at the core of linguistic competence. In one of his letters to Lady Victoria Welby, a British logician at that time, he wrote that it'd be a very good educational idea if some sort of diagrammatic logic was taught to kids at school before they're taught any grammar of any natural language. Another thing is that Peirce was a left-handed person, and he often blamed his left-handedness for his incapacity of linguistic expression. And you know, everybody who ever read Peirce knows that his style times as well. Quite something, to say the least. And being left meant for Peirce, at the same time, being a capable logician. interestingly enough, talking about his own studies in logic, he often used the word addiction, especially often in his application for Carnegie Grant in 1902. He basically writes there that he needs a dose of logic every day. He also persistently referred to his inability for ethical self-control and general disposition against social conventionality, which he again explained in part by his leftism. And to this habit, we might also add a severe, constant self-analysis and considerable interest in different theories of natural conditions of criminality, which were quite popular among lawyers at that time. And besides Cesare Lombroso, one of the founding fathers of modern criminalistics, was one of Peirce's favorite authors. He likes to read. In one of his letters to William James, Peirce once wrote that, quote, "I have been forced to study myself until I have become a devoted sea otanologist." As Joseph Brandt writes in his Peirce biography, Peirce was also able to use both of his hands in writing simultaneously. That is, he was able to really shock his students by writing on a blackboard ambidextrously and simultaneously the mathematical problem and its solution. I mean, can you imagine that? Two different texts at the same time. So visual diagrammatic thinking, mathematics, left-handedness, troubles with written language, unconventional behavior, and logic, all these things in Peirce's case closely connected with each other. They composed, so to say, a sort of Gordian knot that Peirce himself craved to untangle. He was sort of puzzled at himself, at his own abilities and features of his own character. Finally, this is what Peirce wrote circa 1906 on the difference between logical and mathematical thinking, which I think is important. Sorry for a couple of long quotations that will follow. The distinction between the two conflicting aims of logic and mathematics results from this, that the mathematical demonstrator seeks nothing but the solution of his problem, and of course desires to reach that goal in the smallest possible number of steps, while what the logician wishes to ascertain is what are distinctly different elementary steps into which every necessary reasoning can be broken up. In short, the mathematician wants a pair of 7-league boots so as to get over the ground as expeditiously as possible. The logician has no purpose of getting over the ground. He regards an offered demonstration as a bridge over a canyon, and himself as an inspector who must narrowly examine every element of the truss, because the whole is in danger unless every tie and every strut is not only correct in theory, but also flawless in execution. But hold, where am I going? Metaphors are treacherous far more than bridges. So it appears, if we believe this formulation, that a person who has both logical and mathematical mindset, both intellectually and psychologically, is apt to experience a significant tension between these two extremes, the extreme of mathematical insight and logical, as Peirce put it, pedestrianism. It was logically pedestrian, mathematically fast. He did use words fast and pedestrian very frequently in his diaries, in his correspondence, as some sort of self-characteristics. So it appears that we need something continuous on the one hand and visual on the other. And this really does sound like sort of a movie. In Peirce's case, the search of mediator between these two extremes resulted in mathematically grounded diagrammatic logic, his so-called existential graphs. Now, It is a well-known fact that during the last years of his life, especially through the 1900s, Peirce struggled a lot to formulate the full-fledged proof of his pragmatism. One of the ways he thought he could do it was by means of reconciling his pragmatism and his theory of science. In this case, the question was how to reconcile the pragmatic maxim with the definition of sign. In other words, how to reconcile, on the one hand, the fact that the meaning of any concept is not any sort of platonic entity, but that it lies in conceivable practical outcomes of our interaction with the object of this concept, which is to say, inconceivable results of laboratory experiment. And on the other hand, the definition of sign as something which stands for something else, for someone in some respect or capacity. So on the one hand, again, consequences of actions, and on the other hand, triadic structure of sign. First thought he had to, these two things had to be translatable into each other. A decade earlier, in the end of 1890s, Peirce introduced a system of graphic logic, as I said, which he called existential graphs. This system of graphs represented a visual language which consisted of relational diagrams. The diagrams were designed as picture-like expressions of thoughts. In a very basic sense, I believe, as I understand it, Peirce understood a diagram in general as anything at all which has parts in relations, which relations resemble relations among different set of entities. So, I mean, that is a metaphor, a diagram is a sort of mapping of one group of relations onto other. In case of existential graphs, the object to be depicted, to be mapped, is thought itself. So in case of existential graphs, being expressed diagrammatically, thinking process was interpretable into a set of moods which had the form of constantly changing and transforming pictures. In other words, the graphs displayed not the linear process of syllogistic structures and forms of thought, but the very process of thinking, its machinery, as Peirce put it, thinking in actu, in action. And it is probably for this reason Peirce called graphs moving pictures of thought. Dealing with graphs, one can actually observe a given argument expressed by a set of graphic conventions. And these graphic conventions were represented as a number of continuously transforming pictures. So observing a graph, we basically do watch a kind of a movie, a logical one. In brief, I'm not sure if I can be clear on that matter, but I understand that there is a way one can read information in a linear manner, and there is a way one can experience meaning visually as a set of transitive states where the text, at any given moment, it's in front of you in the state of its transition, but as a whole. So you see picture that changes. Now, Peirce's graphs had two features. First, by means of a set of transformational rules, they were so designed as to show the immediate logical continuity of thinking. Second, these rules of transformation were conceived not as any sort of deep grammar, but as a surface structure. All these cuts, dots, lines of identity, iteration structures, and other conventions of existential graphs Peirce invents and makes use are purely graphic expressions. They are shown for what they are, being non, most of them non-arbitrary, and that is not separated, not different in essence from what they actually convey. That is to say, and I'm afraid I'm going to say something that I do not understand myself, the logical form of every graph was an integral part of its content. I'm not sure if it sounds too good enough, but it's like conveying information and simultaneously in one act, in the same act, explaining how you do that. Two acts in one. In this case, so to say, seeing something and understanding how it works is one and the same thing, one and the same process. What is stated and how the statement is done is actually one and the same process. The structure is given on the surface. It's not somewhere deep there. Indeed, for the reason that Persis' pragmatic maxim was conceived by him as, in a way, an expression of his theory of meaning, which provides a conceptual link between thinking and doing, it is not surprising that by the mid-1900s, Peirce began considering his graphic logic to be one of the attempts at the proof of his version of pragmatism. It is obvious then that for Peirce, the possibility of visual representation, not only of linguistic, but of semiotic relations in general, was essential for making the most of his pragmatist approach to meaning. It's interesting that one of important papers written by Peirce on graphs, Prolegomena to an Apology for Pragmatism, begins with the following imaginary dialogue. But why use maps when the thought itself is present to us? Such substantially has been the interrogative objection raised by an eminent and glorious general. Recluse that I am, I was not ready with the counter question which should have run, general, you make use of maps during campaign, I believe. But why should you do so when the country they represent is right there? Thereupon, had he replied that he found details in the maps that were so far from being right there that they were written, that they were within enemy's lines, I ought to have pressed the question, am I right then in understanding that if you were thoroughly and perfectly familiar with the country, no map of it would then be of the smallest use for you in laying out your detailed plans? No, I do not say that, since I might probably desire the maps to stick pins into, so as to mark each anticipated day's change in the situations of the two armies. Well, General, that precisely corresponds to the advantages of a diagram, of the course of a discussion. Namely, if I may try to state the matter after you, one can make exact experiments upon uniform diagrams. And when one does so, one must keep a bright lookout for unintended and unexpected changes thereby brought about in the relations of different significant parts of the diagram to one another. Such operations upon diagrams, whether external or imaginary, take the place of experiments upon real things that one performs in chemical and physical research. The diagrams, then, it appears, are maps of thought, which may be used to stick pins into in order to make anticipated changes. Again, in the very beginning of 1900s, in 1902, Peirce wrote an entry on the concept of virtual for Mark Baldwin's Dictionary of Philosophy and Psychology. This entry, concise as it is, also may be considered as a sort of corollary for his later attempts at the proof of pragmatism. In the dictionary, Peirce gives the following definition of the virtual object. A virtual X, where X is a common noun, is something that is not an X, which has the efficiency, virtues of an X. This is the proper meaning of the word, but it has been seriously confounded with potential, which is almost its contrary. For the potential, X is of the nature of X, but is without actual efficiency. A virtual velocity is something, not a velocity, but a displacement, but equivalent to a velocity in the formula. What is gained in velocity is lost in power. And one more meaning of the virtual. Virtual is something that is used to mean pertaining to virtue in the sense of an ethical habit. And that's pretty interesting. According to this definition, any sign at all is obviously a virtual unit, and so far as its meaning ultimately lies not in any sort of abstract idea or mental copy of an object, but in its object's conceivable practical applications, or in other words, certain habits of conduct that this sign is capable of producing. Consequently, any belief caused by a sign or signs always has some sort of pragmatic content and is consistently interpretable as both an intelligible object and a source for action. Thus, it appears that the concept of virtuality provides an important link between Peirce's late pragmatism and his mature semiotic theory. However, keeping in mind Peirce's notion of virtuality, as well as importance he attached to diagrammatic representations, curiously enough, some hints of affinity between the two parts of his philosophical doctrine may be also found in his early activities as a practical scientist and in his quincunculo projection in particular. As it was already mentioned, let me come again to the map. Peirce's map, like other conformal maps, preserves angles between curves on the map exactly as they are on a sphere throughout the entire face of the map. And if we take just one quincunx pattern, we will see that it is divided into fragments, each presenting one of the hemispheres in the center, while the other is split into four triangles surrounding it. So that the map is conformal everywhere except its corners. At the corners, conformity of angles fails. Also, the map can be tessellated, as I show, with each copy's features exactly matching those of its neighbors. Oops, however, due to repetitions of fragments arranged in a quincunculo manner, this two-dimensional map reveals an important feature. As I said, we can lay a continuous route of any length on this map. Now, anyway, Oh, it's working. Oh, okay. So, say we moved from, I don't know, on this map, from here to here. We do this move. When we do this move, we make a full circle. We make a full turn on the imaginary sphere. But we are, by moving from this point to this point, we find ourselves in a different spot of the map. And if we continue moving some other direction, if we continue moving along, we will, so to say, enter different a different spheric surface. In fact, depending on the length of our imaginary or real route we want to lay, and on how far we want to go with the tessellation, the flat surface of this map actually represents certain number of surfaces. So this this two-dimensional picture. Each fragment of it cannot depict the whole sphere, because we need to make all the points and parts of the sphere be connected on a two-dimensional picture. We have to make some amount of replications, and until we do that, the sphere is not represented. But when we did that, and when we start when we move along, even when we make a circle, we, so to say, find ourselves in a different position, and so in short, the trick with this map is that this map cannot represent one spherical surface, but it represents many of them, two minimum. Do you know what I mean? It's really hard to explain. To represent that, this map preserves angles between curves as in a sphere. But in order to represent a sphere, we have to depict all the points and parts on the sphere to be connected between each other. This can be done in this two-dimensional map only by replication, by tessellation of this map. And when we start tessellating it, we get the whole picture, but we right away get more than one spherical surface. You know, it does not represent one sphere, but when we replicate it a sufficient amount of times, it represents several of them right away. It's okay. We count. I count these pieces that are sufficient for representing all the points and parts of the sphere to be connected with each other. It appears that we need we need to replicate this map three times. So all the parts and points on the map appear to be mutually connected when the number is three. So the full representation of all connections take a territory of three spheres. Again, the map cannot represent the whole sphere, the whole surface of a sphere in any of its fragments, but it represents a number of such surfaces as a sum of those fragments. And this multiple identical spherical surfaces are actually seen as this two-dimensional space where fragments are arranged in a quincunquel pattern. And granting the foregoing Peirce's definition of a virtual X as something not an X, which has a efficiency of virtues of X, Peirce's quincunquel map may be considered as an interesting example of a diagrammatic sign of a spherical representation of the Earth. That is an example of two-dimensional picture, which virtually is a three-dimensional object, precisely because it has virtues of it. That is, it acts like a sphere. Well, that is all I have to say. Thank you.